March wind. Kimmy Gibe has a magic eight ball, a round black globe with a clear window in which brief messages appear. Yes, maybe, most definitely. The girls stand close together, making their backs into a wall that shield the magic eight ball from the jealous gaze of St. Michael's Church across the street. Occasionally, somebody twists her head to watch the boys who are playing kickball in the dirt field next to the school. "Isn't this a sin?" Jennifer Robbie says.
"Not if you really don't believe in it," Kimmy says.
"Who wants to ask it something?" But everybody knows she'll pick Amy because Kimmy wants Amy to be her best friend. Amy takes the magic eight ball, closes her eyes. "You have to tell us your question," Kimmy bosses, "and it has to be a question that can be answered yes or no." Amy cannot think of a question. She waits, rubbing the cool, smooth surface of the magic eight ball. She listens to the shouts of the boys, the thunk of the red rubber kickball. On Valentine's Day, the boys had tricked a first grader into licking the metal hydrant. The first grader hung there helplessly, making low grunting noises like a pig or a cow. His tongue had been the exact same color as the kickball. At home, when Amy told him about it, Fritz had laughed. "Stupid one, just like Jimmy," he said. And she'd understood that once her father had been that boy. The questions Amy has cannot be answered yes or no. Secret and terrible things are hidden everywhere in this world.
"Give it to me if you're just going to stand there," Lynn Peters says, and she grabs the ball away. "Magic eight ball, does Clayton Gordell like me?"
"The answer is no," Amy says, but Lynn shakes the magic eight ball and peers eagerly into the window. Then she blinks and her mouth folds in on itself. She shrugs, pretending it doesn't matter.
"I told you," Amy says. "Clayton likes Jennifer Robbie."
Jennifer Robbie blushes. The other girls stare at Amy curiously. The bell rings, and Kimmy hides the magic eight ball beneath her coat.
"How come you didn't ask it a question?" she says, matching her step to Amy's, allowing the other girls to pass by so the two of them can walk alone.
"I already know everything," Amy says. Kimmy shakes her head.
"Saying that is an even bigger sin than this magic eight ball," she says,
and she reaches out to touch Amy's coat eagerly, reverently. It's an ugly coat with worn rabbit fur around the hood, a hand-me-down from one of Amy's older cousins.
"Trade coats with you next recess," she says, as Amy knew she would.
Amy walks home from school dragging Bert by the hand, her ears pricked to catch the slightest whisper Eliza and Missy might send from the air. Bert hangs back, sucking his chapped thumb. His nose is running from the cold.
"Don't walk so fast," he says thickly.
But Amy jerks him along, a fish on a line, and he follows her because he loves her, and because he is the sort of little boy who always does what people tell him to do. When they get home, Mary Margaret lets them in and wipes his nose with a handkerchief. The handkerchief is scented with gardenia and makes Bert sneeze.
"You didn't dress him properly," Mary Margaret says. "Schrecklich."
She's still wearing her bathrobe, and the ruffled belt pinches her thin body almost into two, like the body of a large, pale insect. The house smells of gardenia and Vicks. Peering down the hall, Amy can see the gray outline of her father sleeping upright in front of the TV.
"I dressed him fine," Amy says. "He's catching cold. Just look at him."
"No, he's not," Amy says. She hangs up their coats, stretching high on tiptoe to reach the wooden bar.
"Ask me any question you can answer yes or no, and I'll bet I'll get it right."
"Smart pants," Mary Margaret says. "You wouldn't give me sass if you was my gal."
"Ask me a question," Amy says to Bert.
"Let's watch cartoons," Bert says, and he goes into the living room and switches the channels quietly so James won't wake up.
"Smart pants," Mary Margaret says smugly to Amy. She sits down at the table where she has a game of solitaire laid out and carefully arranges the hem of the robe to cover her feet. "You don't know anything."
"You're going to lose," Amy says. "I'm sure of it."
But Mary Margaret peeks beneath the turned-over cards, then shuffles through the extras until she finds the one she wants.
"That's cheating! You're cheating!" Amy says.
Mary Margaret laughs. She peeks under another card.
"You'll wake up your father yelling like that, and then you'll catch it good." "Cheater!" Amy hisses.
Abruptly, just inches above Mary Margaret's head, Eliza and Missy appear. They thrash the air with their wings. Their tiny pink mouths are open.
Their sharp white teeth are fierce. They tell Amy she will pay.
"What are you staring at?" Mary Margaret says.
That night after supper, Amy goes to her room and writes about angels in her journal. "Without a guardian angel to protect you, there is no hope for you in this world. For only a guardian angel can see the secret things, the terrible things that hide within every second. Say that you are walking down the street, and suddenly you feel you have to cross to the other side. You must cross to the other side, and so you do. Because that's your guardian angel looking out for you, and if you don't listen, a car could run up on the sidewalk where you were standing and squash you flat. Or say that someone is telling you a lie, and nothing about their face shows that they are saying anything but the truth, but you know they are lying anyway, and you smile at them because you don't know what else to do. You don't need a magic eight ball if you have a guardian angel. You already can feel all the answers to questions that can be answered yes or no." She looks up to see Ellen watching her from the doorway. "Homework?" Ellen says. "We have to keep a journal." "Sounds interesting." "Not really." "Then would you mind giving Bertie a bath? I'd like to go for a walk." "Where to?" "Nowhere in particular. You don't mind putting yourself and your brother to bed?" Amy constructs a careful face. "I don't mind," she says. She doesn't ask if she may go along because Ellen will come up with an excuse why she can't. "Thank you," Ellen says formally, and Amy realizes her mother's face is as carefully constructed as her own. When she goes into the living room to fetch Bert, Ellen is already wearing James's big overcoat, her mouth and nose hidden by a scarf. She says, "See, Amy's here to give you a bath. I'll be back soon, honey. I'll come and kiss you goodnight." "No," Bert says, "stay." He's curled up on the couch, small and neat as a cork. Beside him, James is wrapped in a quilt. "Don't you start now," he says to Bert, who is sniffling behind his thumb. "Little sissy boy," Mary Margaret says. "Don't go," Bert says, and he begins to cry. "Bertie, I'll be right back. I'm just going for a short walk." "Hassimfuss," Mary Margaret teases. "Mama's boy." Fritz turns to James. "Jimmy, do we got to listen to this every goddamn night?" "Herbert, that's enough," James says harshly. "Bertie, I'll be right back, okay?" "It's you who's making him cry like that," James says to Ellen. "I'm not making him do anything." "It's you who's his mother," James says. "How come you want to leave him like this?" "Because it's the only way I can get any time for myself around here," Ellen says. "You're his father, even if you don't act like it. For once, you take some responsibility." "I'm sick," James says. "I don't know what you expect me to do." "I expect help," Ellen says. She gestures at Amy's grandparents. "I married you, not them," she shouts. "I didn't sign up to be anybody's servant." "Bert, please," she says. Herbert howls. "Christ, Jimmy," Fritz says. "She don't like it here. She is free to find somewhere else." Amy steps forward and grabs Bert's hands. "Come on, I'll get your water ready," she says, and she tows him, still crying, to the bathroom. She closes the door and turns on the water so the voices from the living room sound only like the echoes of voices. As soon as he hears the sound of water, Bert stops crying and pulls down his pants to pee. "She's going to be okay," Amy says. "No, she's not," Bert says. He finishes and steps out of his pants, dripping. "She's going to get bit by a dog with rabies. She's going to die and never come back." "Arms up," Amy says. And Bert lifts his arm so she can pull off his shirt. She breathes in the boy smell that comes off his body. If only he believed in angels. But she has tried many times to make him understand, to show him Eliza and Missy, to prove to him that her own guardian angels are powerful enough to protect them all. "But I don't see any angels," Bert says. "You're not supposed to see them," Amy explains. "You just have to know." "Ask me a question," Amy says. "Ask me any question that can be answered yes or no." Bert gets into the bathtub, squats, bobs his bottom in and out of the water, getting used to the temperature. "Is Mom coming back?" "Very definitely," Amy says. She gets a washcloth and rubs warm circles over his back, scratching around his shoulder blades until he straightens up and makes them stick out. "Wings," Ellen calls them. "Wings," Amy says. "You don't know,"
Bert says sadly. You think you know, but you don't. Only God knows if something's yes or no.
There's a scratch at the door, and James comes in, the quilt hanging from his waist like a colorful skirt.
What's going on? He says.
Shut the door, Amy says. There's a draft.
But James just stands there staring at Bert's small body, at his penis, which is curled and pink as a shrimp.
Dunk your head, Amy says to Bert.
Aren't you getting too old to let your sister see you naked? James says.
Shut the door,
Amy says again, and this time James obeys.
A big boy like you, James says.
Amy rubs shampoo into Bert's baby fine hair. His head falls back against her hands. His eyes close. His neck moves loosely, and he makes a soft, contented sound.
A big boy your age, James says.
They ignore him. He paces the two steps between the frosted window and the door, dragging the quilt through small puddles of water. He coughs, wipes his eyes.
It's awful to be sick like this, he says,
and he peers at himself in the mirror. Amy cups warm water over Bert's hair. He giggles when it runs into his ears.
Go away. You will go away now,
Amy thinks as hard as she can. But it is several more minutes before James wanders out, leaving the door open behind him. Amy closes her eyes and sees her mother walking through the darkness, arms pumping, moving faster and faster until she lifts off the sidewalk and into the wide night sky, far away from Amy. Amy tucks Bert into bed just like her mother would, saying the same bedtime prayer, kissing him on the same place beneath his chin. Then she gets into her own bed, leaving the lamp on the nightstand glowing, and writes in her journal. Perhaps there's no God, or perhaps all of us together make up God. But with a guardian angel, you don't need anyone but yourself, and soon, if you pay attention, you don't even need your guardian angel anymore. The angel kisses you goodbye and moves on to someone else, perhaps another girl, or an old man, or even a cat or a dog, because angels can't tell the difference. Angels can fall in love with anyone. Angels are the most beautiful things in the world. She stops writing and reaches out to touch the lampshade, which is decorated with angels in long white gowns. For a brief moment, she is lonely for Eliza and Missy, who used to sleep beside her every night.
Burning the midnight oil, James says,
and Amy whips her journal beneath the covers because she did not see him standing in the doorway, not exactly in or out of the room.
Yes, Amy whispers, not wanting to wake Herbert. Is Mom home yet?
No, James says. I'm home.
He doesn't want you, Amy says.
James takes one step through the doorway. His shadow stretches high on the walls.
Let me tell you something, he says. It's hell having kids. Can you remember that?
Amy does not say anything.
Say it.
Herbert moans in his sleep. It's hell having kids, Amy repeats.
Good. James says.
He runs his hands through his hair. His eyes are wet. He blots them with a tattered tissue. Amy doesn't need Eliza and Missy to tell her how much he doesn't want to be here, how much he wants to be wherever it is he goes when Amy forgets to think of him. They turn in their journals just before noon recess. When they come back inside 30 minutes later, cheeks bright with cold, Sister Justina greets them with an angry look, which sweeps around the room until it descends upon Amy.
Amy Greer, Sister Justina says, and her beautiful voice is filled with stones. You will bring your journal to Father Bork. He is expecting you.
Amy takes the journal from Sister Justina, gets her coat from her hook in the hall, and walks across the street to Father Bork's office. The office is in the living room of the priest's house, which huddles against the side of the church. The housekeeper, Mrs. Hockman, lets Amy in and ushers her in with small arthritic steps to the couch. Mrs. Hockman is in her 70s and has been the parish housekeeper for over 30 years. The look on her face says she has seen all sorts come and go, but that undoubtedly Amy is something worse. She tries to take Amy's coat, but Amy clings to it firmly because she is terrified of Father Bork, just as all the girls are terrified of Father Bork. There are stories that he pulls girls' dresses up to spank them, and although Ellen says it's all garbage, Amy waits on the couch with her coat buttoned up to her chin. When Father Bork comes in, he sits on the couch beside Amy without looking at her. He crosses his legs, folds his hands, and leans back into the cushions as if he is planning to sit there for a long time. He fixes his lap with a gaze that is not angry but very sad. "Do you know what this is about?" he murmurs to Amy after several minutes have passed. His deep voice sounds as if it has been broken beyond repair. Amy places the journal gingerly between them. "This, I guess."
"You guess?" he says. He makes no move to touch it. "Do you know why what you have written here is wrong?"
"I thought I could write about whatever I wanted."
"It sounds here as though you think you are God. It sounds here as if you think you know things other people, older grown-up people, do not. And it admits that you have a magic eight ball."
"It isn't mine."
"Whose is it?"
Amy does not say anything.
"I'm not angry," Father Bork says, and he fingers the journal, stroking it lightly. "But I am concerned. Think of how you are hurting God. Think of how much he loves you, yet look at the pain you are causing him."
Father Bork puts the journal on the coffee table and drapes his arm around Amy. "He's going to spank me," Amy thinks. "He's going to lift my dress." She calls out to Eliza and Missy, "Emergency! Emergency!" But they do not appear.
"What I'd like to do is offer you the sacrament of confession. Just tell me you are sorry, and God will forgive you everything."
Amy imagines Eliza and Missy, their yellow gowns, their white sharp teeth. If you imagine something hard enough, you can make it happen. But nothing happens, nothing at all. She is alone with Father Bork, sitting beside him on a couch that smells of cigarettes, his arm like a boa constrictor squeezing her to his flickering tongue.
"Can you say, 'I am sorry, Lord, for my grievous sins'?"
Amy bursts into tears.
"Well, that's good enough," Father Bork says. "For your penance, say 4 Hail Marys and contemplate humility. Then take what you have written and throw it into the trash. I absolve thee in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Can you say amen?"
"Amen," Amy whispers, hating everything. After Father Bork lets her go, Amy does not return to her class as she has been told to do. She starts to walk home, but then she remembers Bert. How will he get home without her? It's an hour and a half before school lets out, and it's too cold to stay outside for that long. If she goes back into the school to wait, a hall monitor will find her and take her to Sister Justina. Amy has no choice but to enter the shelter of St. Michael's Church, to dip her fingers in the holy water, to genuflect out of habit. She sits in the very last pew, hands tucked into her pockets as if they are hiding there. For the past few months, Ellen has been waking at night, rigid with terror, afraid of her own death. The first time it happened, she thought the feeling was something that would pass, like a bad cramp or a headache. She curled herself against James's silent body, nose pressed into the hollow between his shoulder blades. Angel's wings, she called those bones when she was a little girl. Her sister Julia could make them stick out at will, and with her wispy blonde hair and wide eyes, she looked just like the paintings of angels at the front of Mom's old Bible. Ellen inhaled James's musty smell, and suddenly the thought of those angels horrified her. Dead people dressed in white, floating through the air like dust, toothless, graceful, bony fingers reaching for her throat. The next time she woke in the night, she had dreamed of the angel of death. The angel looked like Julia with her feeble pink wings, but when she opened her mouth to speak, Ellen saw two eyes shining from within the depths of her throat, and knew she had come to drag her from her life. She sat up in bed, turned on the light, and those eyes dissolved into the air. That night she was glad James was away, afraid her skin might crumble at the slightest touch, and instead of blood and guts and bone, what would ooze from her would be dust. Tonight she wakes up because she dreamed that she has died. As she lies beside James, breathing hard, she can still feel her bones being drained of calcium, the cells in her organs sloughing away, her very self dissolving. Just before he died, her father made a dollhouse for Ellen and her sisters, and after he finished it, he carved a doll to look like each of them. He began with Miriam, the oldest. He had just finished Julia when he died, so Ellen was the only one who didn't have a doll. Still, she loved to look through the windows of that dollhouse and into the perfectly ordered rooms, where each doll was frozen before her single task, washing the dishes, ironing the clothes, making the beds, her feet held in place by tiny silver nails. In her dream, Ellen peered through the dollhouse windows and saw a figure carved to look like her. Delighted, she tried to reach for it, but her arms would not move, and she realized she was the doll, lifeless, an empty husk. She gets up, puts on her robe, and goes down the hall to the kitchen. By now she has learned the secret sounds that the house makes after midnight. The hum of the refrigerator, the settling of the floorboards in front of the sink, the scratch of the crabapple tree against the window when the wind blows, and she senses she isn't alone even before she turns on the light. Amy is sitting at the kitchen table with her head buried in the crook of her arm. Her hair is unbraided, tangled against the back of her neck. She lifts her head, blinks sleepily. "Honey," Ellen says, the nightmare fading, "what are you doing?" "It's good for your back to sleep sitting up. I read it in a book." "Does your back hurt?" Ellen says, and she rubs Amy's bony shoulders. "No," Amy says. "Would you like some warm milk?" Ellen says. "Milk has vitamins. That's good for a strong back, too." "I guess." Ellen takes two cups from the cupboard and heats a pan of milk, grateful to have something to do with her hands. She knows she hasn't been spending time with either of the children the way she used to, inventing weekend projects, poring over their assignments from school. She just doesn't seem to have the energy anymore. She's tired, short-tempered, her mind always wandering. 6 months ago, she would have simply taken Amy into her arms, asked her what was wrong, and Amy would have told her. Now, she often feels awkward with Amy. Amy has pulled away from her, keeping secrets, telling occasional lies. At work, she has been tired, too, and the students are starting to notice. She finds herself blowing up in the classroom over little things that once she would have laughed at. "Mrs. Greer is a crab," she heard a little boy say on the playground, and the circle of children standing around him nodded their heads like a small, fierce jury. "They're vultures," Barb said affectionately when Ellen told her about it over lunch one day. "They start to circle the minute they sense that something's wrong." Ellen stirs the milk and the skin sticks to the rough wooden spoon. She's always been a skillful teacher, a good mother. She doesn't understand why that has changed, why lately she isn't interested in anything anymore. "I got in trouble today at school," Amy finally says. "What kind of trouble?" "They didn't like my journal. Sister sent me to Father Bork, and he made me take confession."
"He made you take confession?"
Ellen brings the cups of milk to the table, sets them down, and sits in the rocking chair by the window.
"Confession is supposed to be voluntary."
"What didn't they like about your journal?" Amy gets the journal from her book bag by the door and gives it to Ellen, shivering in her bare feet and thin nightgown.
"Here, come sit with me," Ellen says quickly, and Amy crawls up into her lap, even though she is way too big and her legs spill over to the floor.
It feels good to hold her this way. When Amy was a very little girl, she sat on Ellen's lap every night, and Ellen read aloud to her, book after book, until one day they discovered Amy had learned how to read. Now Ellen reads silently, turning page after page. She remembers her own magical game she played at 10, at 12, bringing the cows back up the lane for milking, never letting number 7 take the lead because her bright white face meant bad luck. Her sisters, too, had their rituals. The toes of Gert's shoes met beneath her bed at night so Gert would never be lonely. Ketty wore her hair twisted into a bun on test days. Even Mom had her own beliefs. On holidays, an extra place at the table was set just in case someone, a guest, a spirit, stopped by. She finishes reading and rocks to and fro, wondering what to do. She knows what her mother would say to Amy about her journal. She would explain that though she loves Amy very much, the church and her teachings must always come first, and things Amy has written here contradict those teachings. "Who do you love more, me or God?" Ellen had asked Mom when she was 10 or 11.
God comes first, Mom said, before anyone, even your sisters and you.
Even now, she remembers the hurt, the sting, as if her mother had slapped her.
So you made the confession, Ellen finally says.
The rocking chair goes creak, creak.
No, Amy says. Father Bork made it for me. I didn't say anything.
That's good, Ellen says. Father Bork is wrong. You don't have anything to be sorry for. Sometimes I want to tell you. But she doesn't finish. The rocking chair goes creak, creak.
After Mary Margaret learned Ellen and James were getting married, she sent them to Father Bork for premarital counseling sessions. The first time they met, he made them memorize the surefire key to a successful marriage.
Sacrifice is never easy, he told them solemnly. Only love can make it easy. Perfect love, he paused, leaning toward them, can make it a joy.
He waited. They waited.
Sacrifice is never easy, he prompted them, and trying to keep straight faces, they chanted it after him until he was convinced that they'd remember it.
They were sitting together on a couch that smelled of cigarettes, nervously holding hands, while Father Bork scrutinized them from behind his desk and sipped coffee from a beautiful cup painted with doves and olive branches. The housekeeper, Mrs. Hockman, was a friend of Mary Margaret's, and she kept coming into the room, first to empty the ashtrays, then to bring Father Bork more coffee. It was apparent that she was eavesdropping. Afterward, James and Ellen tried to laugh about it, but they knew their marriage and its circumstances were the topic of many conversations. They had to attend 3 counseling sessions, and at each one, Ellen promised more of herself to James. She must always obey him because man is the head of woman as God is the head of the church. She must bear James as many children as God saw fit. She must raise those children to be Catholic, and as their mother, she was responsible for their souls and James's as well.
You are the hearth and home, Father Bork said. If the fire in the hearth burns out, the family dies.
Don't listen to what they say, Ellen says to Amy. Just don't listen. Her voice is sharper than she meant it.
The rocking chair goes creak, creak.
Don't listen. Don't listen. The house is quiet except for the hum of the refrigerator, the scratch of the crabapple tree, the faint, distant barking of a dog.
Navigation. Ellen grew up with a man who is their waiter. His name is Roy, and though it doesn't show, she knows he has a rooster tattooed high on his forearm. In high school, he used to flaunt it, pushing up his sleeve, flexing his elbow to make the rooster stretch its neck as though it were about to crow. Kids crowded around him to see, and for a while all the boys talked about getting tattoos, what design was their favorite, what their parents would do. Now, like Ellen, Roy is past 30, and a rooster tattoo is the sort of thing that makes people smile little wise smiles and shake their heads. A rooster tattoo no longer fits into his life, which is quiet, perhaps even dreary, Ellen thinks, noticing the way he smiles at Barb as he guides the menu onto her plate. He winks before he turns away. It's my time of the month, Barb announces long before he is out of earshot. She shakes her head and her yellow sunflower earrings clatter. I could eat every last thing under dessert. Barb's 4th grade class has been moved to the room across the hall from Ellen's 5th grade. Sometimes Ellen is distracted by Barb's high, clear voice. I should have been a mezzo, Barb likes to say. And she thinks of their growing friendship with a mixture of pleasure and disbelief. They share their lunches in the teacher's lounge. Barb is a vegetarian, and over the past few weeks, Ellen has tasted interesting foods like bean sprouts and herb cheese. Barb teaches in hip-hugger jeans and brightly colored turtleneck sweaters, the clatter of her bracelets ringing like tiny bells. She is the first person Ellen knows personally who thinks there's nothing wrong with women's lib. Once a week, they work recess duty together, walking between the swings and the slide, taking turns patrolling the far edge of the playground by the parking lot. Ellen wonders, with the same self-consciousness she remembers from childhood friendships, what Barb sees in her. Whenever she thinks of herself, she sees a pencil sketch, wobbly and frail, with arrows pointing to each part, leg, arm, hair. There are ways, she knows, to imply mother, wife, teacher. But there is no part of herself which she can imagine labeling friend. "What are you getting?" Barb asks, chipping fingernail polish from a tapering nail. Moments ago, Ellen was grimly determined to stick to her diet and order just coffee, black. But the day calls for an ice cream sundae. This morning, walking to school with the children, she saw geese fly over Vinegar Hill, and she marveled at how they navigated through neighborhoods where all the houses looked the same, lined up in tidy rows without a river, a mountain, a lightning-split tree for a landmark. Flight is something Ellen can imagine, even wish for. Navigation has always been a mystery. It is hard enough to travel through well-known streets and rooms and hallways, but how does one navigate wisely through tomorrow, the next day, the next week? Ellen sighs and closes her menu. There are only 2 more weeks of teaching until Easter vacation begins. Still, she doesn't know how she can wait that long. At school, the children are restless, throwing mud balls at recess, doodling on their worksheets during math. At home, Amy and Herbert have divided their bedroom into sides, mine and yours, and they argue the borders with all the vigilance of 2 small hostile countries. "A sundae, I guess," she says, just as Roy reappears. "Excellent choice," he says, scribbling on his pad. "How's Jimmy doing?" Ellen stares at his high pink forehead, remembering how his hair used to grow curly and thick. "He's okay." "Is he home right now?"
"Until Saturday."
"Where's he off to then?"
Somewhere west, I think," Ellen says vaguely.
She doesn't like to talk about James in front of Barb, who is divorced and petitioning for an annulment. She tries to minimize the differences between herself and Barb whenever she can. Sometimes she pretends she is single, too, and can come and go as she pleases, eat whatever she likes, sleep in a bed with lavender sheets that smells only of herself, wear red and orange and purple turtlenecks that a husband would say are too young. James's name hangs between them like a foreign word, pretentious, something that doesn't belong.
"And what can I get for you, hon?"
Roy finally turns to Barb, his eyes suggesting endless possibilities.
"A little shortcake, maybe? We got fresh strawberries."
"How fresh?" Barbara says, loading the word.
"Fresh," Roy says. "Sounds good," Barb says.
And Roy picks up the menu, sweeping the side of his hand across her arm. Barb watches the tight curve of his jeans as he walks back to the kitchen, and Ellen struggles with a vague sense of jealousy. "He's married, you know," she says somewhat sharply. 4 kids, and he has a tattoo."
"Well, tattoos can be interesting if they're in the right place," Barb says diplomatically.
"I wouldn't know."
"No tattoos on old Jimbo?"
Ellen laughs. "James with a tattoo?"
"Didn't you ever date a guy with a tattoo before you got married?"
"I never dated anyone but James," Ellen says.
And as soon as she said it, she feels she has stepped over an invisible line and become too intimate, too revealing. She imagines Barb is embarrassed for her, and she suddenly pictures Barb's adolescence, formals and dances, proms and homecomings, Friday night movies with boys who tilted their heads to hear the bright music of her bracelets, which must have been so risque. Her own Friday nights she spent doing chores. To boys, she was never anything more than a good sport, a cute kid.
"I was sort of a grind," she says quickly, "always with my nose in a book."
"How did you meet James?"
Ellen searches for a lie but can't find one. "He was one of my sister Julia's boyfriends, and she wanted to get rid of him. I was home for Easter vacation, and every time he called, she made me say she was sick. So one day he asked me out instead."
"Oh," Barb says. "Well."
They look away from each other and gaze awkwardly around the diner. It is small. 6 tables, 2 red vinyl booths, and a row of stools along the counter. Buoys hang from the ceiling, and one wall is covered by plastic sand dollars and lobsters and crabs pinned to a fishing net. The nautical theme is for the summer tourists, who will be too charmed by the quaintness of Holly's Field to remember that lobsters aren't found in Lake Michigan. Tourist season, though, is still months away, and the diner is almost empty. A man dressed in coveralls perches on a stool, picking clay from between the cleats of his boots with a pencil tip. An older couple shares a piece of raisin pie, alternating bites. Ellen stretches her neck to peer out the window at Barb's red Camaro, which is parked in front of the fire hydrant. "My divorce car," Barb calls it. Father Bork has summoned her to his office on several occasions, quoting letters from parents concerned about the moral integrity of a Catholic school that employs divorced teachers who drive flashy cars, smoke cigarettes in public, date men before their annulments are official. What effect might Barb have on young minds, these parents ask. What would Barb have Father Bork reply? She still takes communion at Sunday Mass, staring him down until he releases the wafer. "I've decided to get married again," Barb says abruptly. "What? To who?" "Oh, I haven't picked him out yet," Barb says. "Let's face it, the options are limited." "Well, I don't know why you'd want to get married again," Ellen says. "I don't know either," Barb says. "Why do you suppose that is?" The day before he left for good, Barb's ex-husband locked her in the garage. The mail carrier found her on his rounds, then went on to spread the story throughout Holly's Field. Barb showed up for work the next day to face a classroom filled with 9-year-olds who knew all the details. "I guess it's because I'm turning 30 soon, and I feel that it's too old not to be settled." "Do you have to be married to be settled?" Barb laughs. "Well, I think it helps. I mean, look at you. You're settled. You've got James and the kids. You know, someone to go home to." Ellen shrugs, rearranges her silverware. She has no right to complain to Barb about her marriage. Barb would think her problems with James are silly after all she's gone through. "So, how will you find a husband?" she asks. "I mean, just choose someone?" Barb laughs. "Of course," she says. But then Roy comes with their orders, and she turns her smile to him. Ellen has known women like Barb all her life. Her sister Heidi, for instance. Heidi can be talking to Mom or Ellen or her best girlfriend in the world, but when a man appears, other women become invisible. "It's natural," Ellen reminds herself. "I don't mind. It doesn't make me angry." She takes up her spoon and pushes it into her sundae, through the soft whipped cream, into the frozen center. "If I could have chosen," she wonders, "would I have chosen James?" She remembers the vinyl interior of his car, an old Chevy he'd bought from Fritz with 2 summers of work. Bits of hay clung to the foam that poked out of the cracks in the seat. A small blue statue of the Virgin was glued to the dash, and a St. Christopher medal hung by a chain from the rearview mirror. The night of the blizzard, when they no longer could see the road, James slipped the St. Christopher around his neck. "Don't worry," he said. "This car never stuck me anywhere." But soon, like a sleepy animal looking for rest, it nosed its hood into a drift. The windshield wipers grew heavy with snow, heavier still until they froze to the glass. "We can't spend the night here," Ellen said. In a sudden panic, she tried to open her door and realized it was sealed with ice. "I'm so sorry," James said again and again. He took her hand, and for the rest of the night they talked, huddled under the stiff wool blanket. And in the morning, when he said, "Well, we ought to get married. What do you think?" She looked into his kind, frightened face and told him, "Yes." She was 20 years old, home from college for Easter vacation, and she had known James most of her life, the way people know each other in towns like Holly's Field. Even now, she can remember him as an altar boy at 8, stumbling over his robe and sending the gold serving platter flying like a discus into the pews. She remembers when he was held back at the end of 6th grade. She remembers him dropping out of his first year of high school to help his dad with the farm the way kids often did back then. She tries to remember other boys, but she can't think of anyone in particular. There's only James, tall and thin, awkward in the old black suit of Fritz's he wore when he picked her up for their first date. 2 months later, just after graduation, they were married. Her wedding dress was the one that Ketty, Heidi, and Julia had worn. Mom said it would bring her luck. It was yellowed under the arms and along the hem. The day of the wedding, Julia pinned the top of the sleeves to the bodice so Ellen would not forget and raise her arms. As her sisters moved around her, Ellen watched them with her eyes half closed, drifting, letting them take control. They were in the downstairs bathroom at her mother's home. After today, it would no longer be her own, and the air was close and warm as water. She doesn't remember fainting, but when she came to, Mom was standing over her with a rag dipped in ammonia. "She's just like Ketty was," Julia said. "You're nervous," Mom said, though Ellen could see that she was afraid it was something else, and for one awful moment she hated her mother for what she was thinking. "It's like this for everyone." "Not for me," Miriam said, suspicious too. "I wasn't nervous at all." "Get her up," Mom said. "She's wrinkling the dress." They smoothed out Ellen's dress, patted her face with a wet washcloth, and took her out to the truck. The fresh air stung her cheeks. It was a clear June morning, and the smell of the henhouse was in the air. Ellen Greer, she thought to herself, trying to make the name sound right. But in her heart, she knew she was still Ellen Schumacher, would always be Ellen Schumacher, and she was ashamed, going into her marriage with a selfish attitude like that. She feels Barb's finger on the back of her hand. Barb is studying her with the same expression she uses when she suspects a fourth grader of telling a lie. "You know," she says, "what I'd really like to do is move away from here, start fresh, maybe live someplace where nobody knows me. Honolulu or Mexico or something. I was just pretending about wanting to get married again." Ellen licks her spoon, trying to act unconcerned, even though she senses a trap. "Why?" "I wanted to see what you'd say," Barb says. "I wanted to see if you'd try and change my mind." Every diet Ellen has tried over the last few years has failed. Dressing for work in the morning, she avoids looking down at herself as she yanks her control-top pantyhose into place. Beside James and Fritz, who are bony as mules, or in the slender shadow of Mary Margaret, or running after Amy and Herbert's quicksilver bodies, she feels bovine and slow, squat, hideous. And it's her own fault. All she needs to take charge of her life is a little self-discipline, a little self-control. But what she feels is out of control, out of focus, out of sync. Lately, she finds herself scrutinizing things so closely that they become unfamiliar. It reminds her of the way when she was a child, she used to say her name over and over until the words stopped making sense and she became disoriented and afraid. Last night, as she got into bed, she noticed her rosary on the nightstand. She picked it up and held the crucifix tightly in her hand, letting its sharp bones dig into her skin. James was already in bed, and when she closed her eyes, still squeezing the crucifix, she did not think about how it would look to him because she knew he would not notice. For years she had looked at rosaries without thinking, but tonight, when she opened her eyes and looked into her palm, she saw not the crucifix, but a man. A dead man, his face stretched in agony. A sudden feeling of nausea shook her. The rosary slithered away, falling to the floor with a clatter that made James turn his head. She saw herself as a young girl, lined up in church with Heidi and Julia, Mom and Gert, uncomfortable in her stiff black shoes and woolen stockings. It was Good Friday, and they were waiting to kiss the feet of the huge crucifix Father Bork cradled as gently as an infant. The line moved jerkily, step by step. As people touched their lips to Christ's feet,
The altar boy rubbed a white cloth dipped in alcohol over the painted pink flesh to kill the germs, although Mom had assured them that that wasn't even necessary. No germs could survive on blessed items. When Ellen's turn came, she froze, her lips already pursed at the sight of those thick pink toes. She stared at the nail driven into his feet. Blood oozed from the hole, and although Julia stood behind her, whispering, "Kiss it, kiss it," Ellen could not. It was Father Bork who lifted those awful toes to her lips. Ellen herself never moved. "What's wrong?" James said. His breath smelled of onions. She remembered how, after they were first married, he kept a tube of toothpaste beside the bed so his breath would be clean and sweet. At night, after he put out the light, Ellen waited eagerly for his hand to find her breast beneath the sheets. When he first realized how much she liked their sex, he'd laughed and shaken his head. Stunned, hurt, she grabbed her pillow and moved out to the couch. It was several weeks before she slept in his bed again, and after that she always held back, unable to trust him fully, resenting how her new shyness seemed to excite him more. Now the thought of sex with him filled her with revulsion. She pointed at the crucifix that hung above the bed. "Do you know what that is?" she said. And before he could answer, because she knew he would answer wrong, she said, "That's a dead man, James, a corpse." Kiss it," Julia had said, those thick pink toes. James shrugged, rolled away. "You think too much," he said. Saturday morning, Ellen gets up before dawn to help James pack. He's going to Minnesota this time, to a Sellers convention that will last 3 days. He sits on the bed in his boxer shorts. She can feel him watching her as she moves around the dark room, filling the battered brown suitcase with his good pants, his casual pants, 4 crisp white shirts, socks, and underwear. He doesn't move to turn on a light, and neither does she. She imagines that her back feels warm where he's been staring at it. A faint glow from the children's nightlight in the hallway tinges the air like a scent. "You better dress," she finally says, wishing he were already gone. She no longer suggests that he look for a job with regular hours. He was home, sick, for 4 weeks in March, and his presence surrounded the house like a shroud. He sided with Mary Margaret whenever she complained about Ellen's poor cooking, Ellen's wastefulness, the inadequate way Ellen ran the house. He fussed at the children. He brooded in front of the TV. Now that he's traveling again, Mary Margaret is subdued. She eats Ellen's cooking with a sigh, but nothing more. Afternoons, she sleeps on the day bed while Fritz plays cards at senior citizens. And when she wakes up, she takes too many of the small yellow pills she keeps in a mother-of-pearl pillbox. Ellen has her own supply of pills, though she is careful to conceal them. After several months of insomnia, she went to Dr. Heisch for a checkup. "You're fine," he said in a way that let her know he wasn't really listening. Afterward, when she went to pay her bill, the receptionist handed her a prescription. "Isn't this addictive?" Ellen asked. "The doctor knows what he's doing," the receptionist said sternly. "It's something to help you sleep." Now Ellen takes one every night, an hour before she goes to bed. Sometimes she takes an extra one because it doesn't seem like the first one is working. And she frequently takes one in the afternoon to smooth away what she feels when she thinks about going home, fixing dinner, cleaning up whatever mess Fritz and Mary Margaret have made during the day. Dr. Heisch has extended her prescription. She may take up to 4 pills per day, as needed, and the new bottle allows 3 refills. She looks forward to each pill, the vague, dizzy warmth that follows. She tries not to imagine saving them up, filling each new prescription until she has enough so she can swallow them all and completely disappear. This morning, it is hard to keep her eyes open as she fingers James's clothes. She hears him stand up and begin to dress. When she turns to face him, he has put on his shirt. His arms and chest, which were invisible, glow white. It startles her briefly. He looks like a ghost. He says,
Do you believe that the Pope is never wrong?
Ellen's thoughts have already drifted to the weather, because if today turns out nice, Barb will take her and the kids for a ride in the Camaro. Perhaps they'll drive up to Herringbone Beach. The kids will amuse themselves finding gull feathers and driftwood while she sits with Barb on a flat, cold stone, bundled together in a blanket. James's question does not belong at the beach, with the sound of the water, the weak gold sun, the throaty calls of the gulls.
I don't know, she says after a moment. The question doesn't seem real.
I want to know what you think.
I'm not sure any of that stuff is true, she hears herself say. She kneels on the suitcase, snaps the locks. James gets up and pulls on his trousers, and the sound of the zipper sends a chill up the back of her neck. It is so filled with rage. He says, "You shouldn't have said that." The darkness breathes between them. He says, "The Pope knows what's best for the church, just like I know what's best for this family. Living with my parents makes the most sense, even if you don't like it." He steps past her, picks up the suitcase, and carries it down the hall in his sock feet. Always, Ellen has fixed him a hot bowl of oatmeal, followed him to the door, kissed him goodbye, and then lingered in the cold air to wave. In Illinois, she had eaten with him, watching carefully as he traced his route in red marker on the map. "By noon, I'll be in Watertown. By 6, I'll be at the Holiday Inn in Westdale." His face would be flushed, still sleepy, and she'd kiss beneath his chin to feel the roughness there, despite his fresh shave, and he'd tilt back his head because he liked that, liked her special way of kissing him. Now, she can feel that he is waiting at the end of the hallway, thinking to himself, "In a minute she'll come." Perhaps he's remembering those mornings, too, when he would lean his chin on her shoulder as she washed the breakfast dishes. She felt his breathing, sad and slow, and she'd pause with her hands in the soapy water, matching her breaths to his own. Although he never spoke of it, she knew how nervous he got before he traveled. She knew that as he stood there, his chin digging into her shoulder, he was telling himself who he was, the husband, the father, the man. And because his fear did not fit those roles, it evaporated into the morning air. But she had said, "I'm not sure any of that stuff is true." Surely he can sense what this might mean. Like heaven, he is part of the natural order of things, something not to be questioned. And like heaven, he has become more distant, more unknowable, like God. James has been slipping away. Ellen has tried to be more religious, to recapture what she used to feel when she prayed. Some days, even now, she gets up early and goes to Mass before work. The wooden pews hold her erect, at attention. The host rises up above the altar, and magic surrounds her like a damp cloud. Then she eats God, swallows him into her, waits for him to fill her up like those nights after work when she buys candy bars in the teacher's lounge and eats them, all of them, one by one, that bright forbidden sweetness. She tries to feel the smugness of faith, to know she is important and that her life has great, if hidden, meaning. But the more she has tried to claim God, the more he has rejected her. She wants to be lost in him, but he vomits her out again and again, and each time he asks even more from her before he'll permit her return. She is proud. She is defiant. She is selfish. She is sinful. There is too much of Ellen in Ellen for God. She sticks in his throat like a bone, and perhaps James, too, finds her unpalatable, sour. "You should not have said that. You should not feel that. You should not be as you are." Across the hall, Fritz coughs in his sleep and begins to snore. It is growing light. James is no longer waiting. The front door opens, closes with a click. Even if she wanted to catch him, she could not. And reminding herself of that brings relief. She gets back into bed, settling into the still warm sheets, and sleeps suddenly, soundly, completely the way she did when she was a child. When she wakes up, it is almost 8. The sun is a yellow slice beneath the curtains, and Herbert is tucked under her arm. "You were sleeping,"
he says in his funny way when he sees her eyes are open. His breath smells like peanuts. He sticks his thumb back into his mouth and sighs contentedly. At breakfast, Mary Margaret knocks the orange juice pitcher to the floor. A piece of flying glass cuts Amy across the top of her bare foot, but no one notices this, not even Amy, until Ellen, on her hands and knees wiping up the mess, sees blood. "Somebody needs a Band-Aid," she announces cheerfully, although a vein of blood trails across the floor. She is hoping it's not as bad as it seems. The kids look down, checking themselves out. Mary Margaret glances at Amy's foot and faints, clattering forward into her plate. It happens so suddenly that, for a moment, nobody moves.
"Ach," Fritz says. "She always faints at blood. How about you, Missy? You gonna faint on us, too?"
Amy looks at him disdainfully. "It doesn't even hurt," she says. Ellen gets up and lifts Mary Margaret by the shoulders, leaving damp marks on her pale pink bathrobe. Bits of stewed prune are smeared in Mary Margaret's hair, and a bruise is forming on the bridge of her nose. A blue vein stiffens between her nose and upper lip.
"Is she dead?"
Amy says, voicing Ellen's thought. But then Mary Margaret opens her eyes.
"Blut,"
she says, and as Fritz laughs, she begins to cry. Horrible, choking sobs. Between breaths, she speaks in German, slapping Ellen's hands away. Then she gets up and goes down the hallway toward the bathroom, patting the wall ahead of her as if she has forgotten the way.
"Never could stand the sight of blood," Fritz chuckles, wipes his mouth with the back of his hand. "Good thing Jimmy ain't here, or he'd keel right over with her."
"I like blood," Amy says firmly. Ellen washes her foot with witch hazel. The cut is deep, but clean. She lets Amy bandage it herself while Herbert looks on, properly impressed.
"How come I never felt it?" Amy says. "Stepped on a nail once, drove it into my foot," Fritz says. "Threw my shoe right up between the bones. Now all day I thought to myself, I got something in my shoe, but you know, I was so darn busy I couldn't be bothered to take a look. Come nightfall, I couldn't get my shoe off. I nailed my goddamn foot to my shoe!" He laughs, showing all six of his teeth, which are stained a cheerful gold.
"What happened?" Amy says cautiously.
"My foot turned black and dropped right off. That's why I got this here false one."
"You have a false foot?" Herbert says while Amy rolls her eyes. "No, he doesn't," she says. "You don't?" Herbert says. And he looks from one to the other. Fritz laughs and laughs. From the bathroom come the soft, soft sounds of Mary Margaret crying. Barb stops by for Ellen and the kids in the afternoon. Ellen hears the horn in the driveway and scrambles the kids into their coats. Barb, like Ellen's mother, like Ellen's sisters, does not come inside. On the way to Herringbone Beach, Barb fiddles with the radio until she finds a Beatles song. She turns the volume way up.
"I'm going to clean out the gas line," she shouts, accelerating past 80.
Ellen marvels at the way Barb can talk about car things like a